A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been noticing the artificial fragrances pumped into hotels and gyms. Those very specific signature scents that building managers apparently put real thought into. Some high-end properties even commission custom scents from boutique fragrance houses. But here's the tension he's zeroed in on. How do legal departments not lose their minds over this? You've got people with perfume allergies, asthmatics who can be triggered by synthetic scents, and plenty of folks who just don't want to be involuntarily fragranced. It's an intrusive sensory thing, especially in residential buildings. So what's the state of play on scent marketing, and are we seeing a pushback toward unscented spaces?
There's a lot to dig into here because this sits right at the intersection of marketing science, property law, disability rights, and, I think most interestingly, a kind of quiet cultural shift that's been building for about a decade. Let me start with the scale of this, because the numbers are genuinely striking. Scent marketing is roughly a $1.5 billion global industry now, projected to hit something like $5 billion by the early 2030s. The company that really pioneered this was a firm called Scentair. They've been around since the mid-90s, and they now have something like 50,000 client locations across over 100 countries.
50,000 locations. So, this isn't some boutique curiosity. This is infrastructure at this point.
It's ambient infrastructure. And the psychology behind it is well studied. There's a landmark study from 2006 by a researcher named Eric Spangenberg. He found that a simple citrus scent in a retail store increased sales by about 20%. Not a complex custom fragrance, just citrus. Another study from the Journal of Marketing found that a warm vanilla scent in a clothing store made shoppers spend about 20% more time browsing. And it's not just retail. Casinos in Las Vegas have been doing this for decades. The Venetian pumps a custom scent through its ventilation system. The Bellagio has one. These are proprietary, chemically engineered fragrances designed to do very specific things. Keep people relaxed. Keep them gambling. Keep them from noticing how much time has passed.
The glockenspiel of aromatherapy, as Daniel put it. Background music for the nose. You're not supposed to notice it, but it's shaping the entire emotional register of the space.
And that's the design philosophy. It's supposed to operate below conscious awareness. The industry term is olfactory branding, or sometimes ambient scenting. The goal is to create what they call an emotional signature for a space. Westin Hotels, for example, has been doing this since about 2005. They have a signature white tea and fig scent that they diffuse in their lobbies worldwide. The Ritz-Carlton uses a custom blend that varies by property but usually centers on something they describe as warm woods and citrus. These aren't afterthoughts. They're commissioned from firms like Scentair or AirQ or Prolotech, and they cost serious money. A single hotel property might spend anywhere from $500 to several thousand dollars a month on scent delivery systems and fragrance cartridges.
The return on that investment is supposed to be, what, exactly, guest thinking. I feel inexplicably good in this lobby, and then booking again.
But it's also about differentiation. The hospitality industry has a problem. Once you hit a certain tier, the physical amenities start to converge. A four-star room is a four-star room. The sheets are nice, the lobby has marble, whatever. Scent is one of the few sensory dimensions where a brand can create something proprietary and hard to replicate. There's research showing that scent-evoked memories are more emotionally potent and longer-lasting than visual or auditory memories. So if you can associate a specific, pleasant scent with your brand, you're embedding yourself in people's limbic systems.
Which is also why this gets legally and ethically complicated. You're not just decorating, you're doing something chemically to people's brains without their explicit consent.
Right, and this is where the pushback comes in. Let me frame the legal landscape because it's patchy and fascinating. In the United States, there is no federal regulation that specifically governs ambient scenting in public or commercial spaces. The FDA doesn't regulate these products as drugs because they're not making therapeutic claims. The EPA has some oversight under the Clean Air Act if the scent delivery involves volatile organic compounds, but enforcement is minimal and mostly focused on outdoor emissions. The Consumer Product Safety Commission has jurisdiction over consumer fragrance products, but ambient commercial scenting falls into this weird regulatory gap. It's essentially self-regulated by the industry.
Nobody's really watching.
Nobody with federal authority, no. What you do have is a growing body of case law around fragrance sensitivity as a disability accommodation issue under the Americans with Disabilities Act. There was a significant case in 2019, McBride versus the City of Detroit, where an employee with severe fragrance sensitivity won a settlement after her employer failed to accommodate her request for a fragrance-free workplace. The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission has issued guidance that fragrance sensitivity can qualify as a disability if it substantially limits a major life activity. But that's employment law. It applies to workplaces, not to hotels or gyms where you're a customer, not an employee.
As a hotel guest, you basically have no legal standing to demand they turn off the scent.
Not under current federal law, no. You could try to bring a claim under the ADA's Public Accommodations Provisions, Title III, but those cases are extremely difficult to win because the business can argue that removing the scent would fundamentally alter the nature of their service or impose an undue burden. And they probably win on that given how central scent branding has become to their business model. There's a 2017 Law Review article by a scholar named Pamela Fuhi that goes deep on this. She argues that the legal framework for fragrance accommodation is basically non-existent in public accommodations, and that this represents a real gap in disability law.
If you're an asthmatic who walks into a scent-branded hotel lobby and starts wheezing, your recourse is basically leave.
Leave, complain to the manager, write a bad review, and hope the market eventually responds. Which, to be fair, it is starting to. The push for fragrance-free spaces has been growing steadily. The American Lung Association has been advocating for fragrance-free policies in public buildings for years. The Centers for Disease Control has a fragrance-free policy for its own offices. The Mayo Clinic implemented a comprehensive fragrance-free policy in 2018 after years of staff and patient complaints. And this isn't just about synthetic fragrances in the air, it's part of a broader movement around multiple chemical sensitivity, which is a contested but increasingly recognized condition. This is tricky. Multiple chemical sensitivity, MCS, is not recognized as a distinct medical diagnosis by the American Medical Association or the World Health Organization. The symptoms are real. People experience headaches, respiratory issues, cognitive fog, skin reactions, but the mechanism is disputed. Some researchers argue it's a physiological response to low-level chemical exposure. Others think it's a conditioned neurological response, or even a psychosomatic condition. The science isn't settled. But here's what matters for our conversation. Whether or not MCS is a distinct disease entity, the prevalence of self-reported fragrance sensitivity is substantial. A 2017 study in the Journal of Environmental Health found that about 31% of American adults report adverse health effects from exposure to scented products. 31%? That's not a fringe group.
Nearly a third of adults. That's a market segment you can't ignore.
And another study, this one by Anne Steinman at the University of Melbourne, published in 2019, surveyed over 1,000 Americans and found that about 20% reported difficulty accessing public restrooms that use air fresheners, about 17% reported difficulty being in stores with ambient fragrances, and about 15% said they'd been unable to use a hotel room because of residual fragrance. These are real access issues. Steinman's work has been especially influential because she's also done chemical analysis of common scented consumer products and found that many of them emit volatile organic compounds classified as toxic or hazardous under federal law, even when the products are labeled green or natural.
Wait, even the ones labeled natural?
Especially those in some cases. The problem is that natural fragrance is an unregulated term. A product can be scented with essential oils, which are chemically complex and can absolutely trigger allergic reactions, and call itself natural, but it's still emitting limonene, linalool, and other terpenes that react with indoor ozone to form formaldehyde and other secondary pollutants. Steinman's research found that over 40% of the volatile organic compounds emitted by fragrance products are classified as toxic or hazardous under at least one federal statute. And manufacturers are not required to disclose fragrance ingredients because they're considered trade secrets under the Fair Packaging and Labeling Act.
Of course they are. The trade secret carve-out for fragrance ingredients is the legislative gift that keeps on giving.
It really is. The International Fragrance Association, IFRA, has its own self-regulatory standards, and they've banned or restricted something like 200 ingredients over the years. But it's voluntary. There's no federal enforcement mechanism. And the European Union's REAC regulation is somewhat stricter, but even there, fragrance ingredients get special treatment. The result is that when you walk into a scented hotel lobby, you have no idea what you're inhaling. The hotel probably doesn't know either. They just know the scent profile was developed by a fragrance house and delivered by a scent marketing company.
Let's talk about the residential angle, because Daniel mentioned that specifically. Scent branding in a hotel is one thing. You're a transient guest. You can leave. But what about apartment buildings and condos where people live?
This is where things get really contentious because you're now talking about people's homes. There's a growing trend in luxury residential buildings, especially in New York, Miami, Dubai, to scent brand the common areas. The lobbies, the hallways, the fitness centers, sometimes even the elevator cabs. The pitch to buyers and renters is that this is part of the luxury experience, like a concierge or rooftop pool. But for residents who don't want it, it's not an amenity. It's an intrusion. You can't opt out of breathing the hallway air on your way to your front door.
There's something almost coercive about it. You chose the apartment for the location and the floor plan, not because you wanted to live inside a Westin lobby. But the scent is part of the package now, and you can't negotiate it out.
It's not just luxury buildings. There's a company called AirQ that specializes in scenting multifamily residential properties. Their marketing materials talk about creating a memorable first impression for prospective tenants and reducing perceived wait times in leasing offices. Another company, Prolitech, has a product line specifically for residential common areas. The industry sees this as a growth market, but resident pushback is real. I found a 2024 article in Multi-Housing News about a condo association in Chicago that got into a protracted legal battle after the board voted to install a scent diffusion system in the lobby. Several residents with asthma and migraines organized against it, brought in medical documentation, and eventually forced the board to reverse the decision. But it took 18 months and tens of thousands of dollars in legal fees.
The burden is entirely on the people who don't want to be fragranced. They have to organize, hire lawyers, disclose medical histories, or the building just gets to pump out whatever it wants until someone stops them.
That's the asymmetry. And it's worth noting that this is the exact opposite of how we regulate other environmental exposures. If a building wanted to pipe in background music into the hallways at a fixed volume that you couldn't control, residents would revolt. Actually, that's a thing too. Piped music in common areas. But at least you can wear headphones. You can't wear a gas mask to take out your trash.
Right. You can close your eyes, you can wear earplugs, but you can't stop breathing. Olfaction is the only sense you can't voluntarily shut off.
Which is why the legal scholar I mentioned earlier, Pamela Fooey, argues that ambient scenting should be analyzed as a form of sensory assault in certain contexts. Her framing is provocative, but she makes a serious point. We have legal frameworks for noise pollution and light pollution, but we have almost nothing for scent pollution. It's a regulatory blind spot that dates back to an era when nobody imagined we'd be engineering commercial fragrances and pumping them through HVAC systems at industrial scale.
What does the hospitality industry say when you ask them about this directly? Are they aware of the pushback? Do they care?
They're aware, and their response is basically three-pronged. First, they argue that the concentrations are very low, typically parts per billion, and well below any established safety threshold for the individual compounds. Second, they point to customer satisfaction data showing that scented properties consistently rate higher on atmosphere and overall experience metrics. Third, and I think most revealingly, many major brands have quietly developed unscented options, but you have to ask for them. Marriott, for instance, has a Pure Room program in some properties that includes fragrance-free air purification. Hilton has allergy-friendly rooms that exclude scented products, but these are opt-in, not the default. You have to know to request them.
Which means the default is still, you will be fragranced.
And the default matters enormously, because most people don't know they can request an alternative, and many would feel awkward doing so. There's a power dynamic here. The fragrance is presented as part of the luxury experience, so objecting to it positions you as difficult or high maintenance. The industry is counting on that social friction to keep the opt-out rate low.
Like adopting a feral cat.
I'm going to need you to unpack that one.
The process is so unpleasant that most people just live with the problem rather than go through it.
That's fair. And there's another layer here that I think is underexplored, the class dimension. Scent branding started in luxury hotels and high-end retail, and is now trickling down to mid-market properties and even budget chains. But the fragrances themselves are different. The luxury properties are using complex custom blends with higher quality raw materials, still synthetic, but more carefully engineered. The mid-market properties often use simpler, more aggressive scents that are designed to mask odors rather than create a subtle emotional signature. So you end up with this weird dynamic where the cheaper the hotel, the more likely you are to be assaulted by an overwhelming synthetic floral or clean linen blast the moment you walk in.
The olfactory equivalent of turning up the volume because the speakers are bad.
And that's where the health impact becomes more acute, because those cheaper scent systems are often less precisely calibrated. They overspray, the concentrations spike, and the fragrance oils used are less refined, which means more chemical impurities. So the people who can least afford to be picky about their accommodations are getting the worst of it.
You mentioned earlier that there's a cultural shift building. What's driving it, beyond the disability rights angle?
I think there are three forces converging. The first is the wellness movement, not the commodified goop version, but a genuine cultural turn toward questioning what we're putting in and around our bodies. The rise of clean beauty, the EWG's Skin Deep database, the whole ethos of ingredient transparency. It's created a consumer base that's much more skeptical of undisclosed chemical exposures. The second is the remote work shift. More people are spending more time in their homes, and they're more attuned to their indoor environment. During the pandemic, a lot of people started running air purifiers and monitoring their indoor air quality, and that awareness hasn't gone away. The third force, which is more recent, is the growing recognition of fragrance as an equity and access issue. There's been really effective advocacy from disability rights organizations framing this not as a preference, but as a civil rights concern.
The industry response to that third one. Have any major brands actually changed their default policies?
Not at scale, no. What you're seeing instead is the emergence of fragrance, free as a market differentiator for a specific segment. There's a hotel brand called The Pure Collection that markets itself entirely on hypoallergenic, fragrance-free rooms. The Four Seasons has a fragrance-free floor option at some properties. In the residential space, there are a handful of new luxury buildings in New York and San Francisco that explicitly advertise as fragrance. Free, but it's still a niche. What I haven't seen, and what I think would be significant, is a major flag making fragrance-free the default and offering scent as an opt-in.
That would be the real test. If Marriott said, our rooms are unscented by default, but you can request a signature scent experience, you'd know the power balance had actually shifted.
And I don't think we're close to that yet because the economics still favor scenting. The research on scent and purchasing behavior is robust. Spangenberg's work that I mentioned, the 20% sales lift from citrus, that's been replicated in multiple contexts. A 2021 meta-analysis in the Journal of Retailing looked at 66 studies and found a consistent, statistically significant effect of ambient scent on consumer behavior across retail, hospitality, and service settings. The effect size varies, but it's real. So for a business, scenting is a relatively cheap intervention with measurable ROI. Removing it is leaving money on the table, or at least that's the perception.
That's the thing. It's the perception. Has anyone studied whether the effect holds when you control for the fact that scented spaces might just be better managed in general? A hotel that invests in custom fragrance is probably also investing in better lighting, better furniture, better staff training.
That's a sharp point, and there is some research that tries to disentangle this. A 2020 study in the Journal of Business Research found that the effect of ambient scent on customer satisfaction was partially mediated by perceived service quality, meaning the scent made people think the service was better, even when it wasn't objectively different. So it's not just that scented spaces are nicer spaces. The scent itself changes your perception of everything else. That's powerful and a little unsettling.
It's manipulation. Let's just call it what it is. It's a form of environmental manipulation that's been market-tested and optimized, and the people being manipulated weren't asked for consent. I'm not saying it's the moral equivalent of something terrible. It's just a hotel lobby. But the principle is the same. You're altering someone's neurochemistry to extract value from them.
I think that's where even people who don't have fragrance sensitivities might reasonably object. You don't have to be an asthmatic to feel that your consent should matter. There's a philosopher, I'm blanking on the name, who's written about atmospheric manipulation as an ethical category distinct from persuasion or coercion. The idea is that when you alter the environment rather than the message, you're bypassing the rational faculties entirely. You're not trying to convince someone, you're trying to make their nervous system do something they didn't decide to do.
That's the core of it. Scent marketing works precisely because it's sub-rational. If you put up a sign that said, feel relaxed and spend more money, people would roll their eyes. But if you pump white tea and fig through the HVAC, their limbic system just...
We should be clear that this isn't new in kind. Spaces have always had smells. Bakeries have smelled like bread, churches have smelled like incense, leather shops have smelled like leather. What's new is the intentional engineering of scent to achieve a specific behavioral outcome, divorced from the actual function of the space. A hotel lobby doesn't naturally smell like white tea and fig. There's no tea, there are no figs. It's a simulation designed to evoke a feeling that the brand wants you to associate with them.
Which brings us back to Daniel's question about legal departments. How have they not killed this? It seems like a liability nightmare. You're exposing thousands of people a day to a proprietary chemical blend, and some percentage of them are going to have a bad reaction.
I looked into this specifically, and the answer seems to be threefold. First, the concentrations really are very low. We're talking parts per billion in the ambient air, orders of magnitude below what you'd get from someone wearing perfume in an elevator. Second, the fragrance houses that develop these scents do conduct safety testing. Not to FDA drug standards, but to IFRA standards, which include dermal sensitization and respiratory irritation assessments. Third, and I think most cynically, the liability hasn't materialized in a way that changes the cost-benefit calculation. There have been a handful of lawsuits, but none that resulted in the kind of massive damages that would make the industry reconsider.
Has anyone actually sued a hotel over ambient scenting?
Yes, but the cases tend to settle quietly. In 2018, a woman in Florida sued a resort after she had a severe asthma attack she attributed to the lobby scent. The case settled before trial. In 2022, a group of residents in a luxury condo building in Los Angeles filed a class action against the developer over the scenting system in the common areas. They alleged nuisance, battery, and violation of disability laws. That one also settled, with the building agreeing to reduce the scent concentration and offer fragrance-free access routes. But because these settlements aren't published, they don't create precedent, and they don't make headlines that would alert other potential plaintiffs or deter other businesses.
The settlements are basically hush money, with a ventilation adjustment.
That's the pattern. And it's effective from the industry's perspective. Each problem is handled quietly, the broader practice continues, and the legal departments can point to the settlements as evidence that they're managing risk responsibly. We addressed the issue, we reached an agreement, there's no admission of wrongdoing. It's the playbook.
What would actually change this? What's the mechanism that shifts us toward unscented by default?
I think there are a few possibilities. One is a high-profile class action that doesn't settle, that goes to trial and results in a verdict large enough to make the industry's actuaries sit up. Another is regulatory action at the state level. California has been the leader here. Their Proposition 65 already requires warnings for certain fragrance chemicals, and there's been discussion in the state legislature about extending indoor air quality standards to cover commercial scenting. If California acts, the national brands will likely follow, because they're not going to maintain separate scent policies for different states. A third possibility is an insurance-driven shift. If liability insurers start pricing ambient scenting as a meaningful risk factor, and there's some evidence they're beginning to, that could change the economics faster than any regulation.
The fourth possibility is just consumer pressure reaching a tipping point. The 31% who report adverse effects, if they get organized and loud enough.
Which is happening slowly. There are advocacy organizations like the Fragrance Free Coalition and the Chemical Sensitivity Foundation that have been pushing for policy changes. Social media has been an accelerant. People share lists of fragrance-free hotels and restaurants. They name and shame properties that refuse to accommodate. They build community around the issue. It's not a massive movement, but it's growing. And I think the generational dimension matters here. Younger consumers are much more likely to view undisclosed chemical exposure as unacceptable, full stop. They've grown up reading ingredient labels on everything. The idea that a building would pump an undisclosed chemical blend into the air just doesn't sit right.
What should someone actually do if they're checking into a hotel and the lobby hits them with an aggressive signature scent? What's the practical playbook?
A few things. First, call ahead. Most hotels that do ambient scenting can arrange a fragrance-free room if you give them notice, and they're often willing to turn off or reduce the scent in the room's HVAC zone. Second, if you're already there and it's a problem, ask to speak to the engineering department, not the front desk. The front desk staff usually can't control the scent system, but engineering can adjust it or shut it off for your floor. Third, if you're booking online, look for properties that have allergy-friendly or pure room categories. They're increasingly common. Fourth, and I think this is underutilized, leave reviews that mention the scent. Hotels pay very close attention to review patterns, and if overpowering fragrance starts showing up as a recurring complaint, they'll adjust. The scent is supposed to be subliminal. If people are noticing it enough to complain, the system has failed.
That last point is interesting. The whole premise of ambient scenting is that you don't notice it. So a complaint is actually a signal that the system is malfunctioning, not that the guest is being difficult.
The industry's own design philosophy provides the counterargument. If I notice your scent, you've done it wrong. And if you've done it wrong, I have every right to ask you to fix it.
Let me bring this back to the residential context for a moment, because I think that's where the most interesting ethical questions live. If you buy a condo in a scented building, are you consenting to the scent? Or is it more like you're consenting to the building as a package, and the scent is bundled in, whether you like it or not?
I think it depends on disclosure. If the scenting is disclosed up front, if you walk into the sales office and they tell you this building has a signature scent in the common areas, then you're making an informed choice, and your recourse if you don't like it is to not buy. But in practice, it's often not disclosed. It's just part of the ambiance that you experience during the tour, and if you don't think to ask about it, you might not realize it's a permanent feature until you've already closed. At that point, you're stuck.
Even if it is disclosed, how permanent is it? The building can change the scent at any time. You might buy into a light citrus building and come home one day to aggressive sandalwood because the board switched vendors.
That's a real problem, and it gets at something deeper. Ambient scenting is a form of ongoing environmental modification that current property law doesn't really have a framework for. If your neighbor plays loud music, you have noise ordinances. If someone's barbecue smoke drifts into your unit, you have nuisance law. But if the condo board votes to pump vanilla cedar through the hallways, there's no specific legal doctrine that governs that. You're in uncharted territory.
Which is probably why those lawsuits keep settling. Nobody wants a judge to actually rule on this and create a precedent one way or the other.
The uncertainty benefits the scenting industry. If there were clear rules, maximum concentrations, mandatory disclosure, opt-out requirements, the business model would adapt. It would probably even survive. But the ambiguity lets them keep doing what they're doing while managing the occasional lawsuit as a cost of doing business.
To answer the prompt directly, yes, there is a push for unscented spaces, and it's coming from multiple directions. Disability rights, consumer transparency, wellness culture, and a growing awareness that consent should apply to your nose as much as your ears or your eyes. But the push hasn't yet overcome the economic incentives that drive scent marketing. The industry is still expanding, the regulatory framework is still patchy, and the default is still, you will be fragranced unless you make a fuss.
I'd add that the most interesting development to watch is whether a major flag hotel or a major residential developer makes fragrance-free the default. That would be the signal that the balance has actually shifted. Until then, we're in this awkward transitional period where the practice is widespread, the pushback is growing, and the law hasn't caught up to either.
For the individual who just doesn't want to be scent marketed, call ahead, ask for engineering, leave the review, and know that you're part of a 31% minority that's not actually a minority. Nearly a third of adults is a constituency. The industry is just hoping you'll stay quiet.
which historically has been a pretty safe bet for them. But I'm not sure it will be for much longer. The transparency genie doesn't go back in the bottle. Once people start asking what's in the air, they don't stop.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In 1487, a Spanish explorer in the Solomon Islands attempted to introduce emmer wheat cultivation to the local population. The crop failed within a single growing season due to the island's humidity, but the abandoned seeds hybridized with a wild grass, producing a short-lived grain variety that islanders called ghost wheat. It vanished entirely by 1510 and was never recorded in any European agricultural text.
I have so many questions, and I know none of them will be answered.
This has been My Weird Prompts, produced by the inscrutable Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps. We're at My Weird Prompts. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. Talk to you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.